every night, crying, praying, asking God, when is the end? I knew victory would be the outcome. I can tell you that. It's been really rough. And when I got the news yesterday, I was just overwhelmed with joy. It's been a long journey.
Yep, it has. But good news at the end.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
Okay.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, also in California in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI and Round Mountains KKRN, up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, Eugene's KEPW, Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day for your listening pleasure on the internets, on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites, blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. Delightful to have you here with us. Delightful for us to be here with you.
Yes, indeed.
That goes for Desi Doyen as well, I guess.
Yes, it does.
All right. Well, voters are heading to the polls on Tuesday for presidential primaries and other elections in Connecticut, New York, Rhode Island, and Wisconsin. Delaware was supposed to have a presidential primary this week. That's Joe Biden's home state. They had previously scheduled it for April 2nd as well, but they canceled both the Republican and Democratic contests since there would have been only one candidate on each ballot in the state. Some voters in Arkansas and Mississippi are also returning to the polls on Tuesday to decide a handful of legislative runoffs to primaries that were held last month. I'm happy to note so far I have yet to come across any problems for voters or voting systems reported in the states where voters are voting on Tuesday, though, as you know, sometimes we don't learn about such problems until later. We'll keep our eyes on that, and we will have noteworthy results, if there are any, on our next broadcast. And while we may learn things from the results of the presidential primaries, even though both parties have already effectively selected their candidates this year, there are some other contests of note around the country that we will pick up on our next show as well. And I've got a bunch of other election and voting related stuff that I hope to get to on today's show shortly. We'll get it to as much as we can. But let's start with some quick news breaking since our previous show yesterday, as we've got a few new developments on a few of the stories that we discussed on that program. Donald Trump posted a $175 million bond on Monday in his New York civil fraud case, halting for now collection of the more than $454 million that he owes. He owes that to the state in full plus interest, and that $175 million bond prevents for now the state from seizing his assets in order to satisfy the debt while he appeals that case. It was due on this $175 million was due on Friday. He turned it in via bond on Monday night. And though $175 million is indeed less than the $454 million that he has been found liable for to New York State, it's still a lot of money. And if Trump loses on appeal, the New York Attorney General will not have to chase down that portion of the penalty, that $175 million will immediately go to the state. Now, as you know, a New York appellate court had given the former president 10 days to put up that money after a panel of judges on that court had agreed last month, without explanation, to slash the amount that would be needed to stop the clock on enforcement of the penalty. In other words, he was always able to appeal that ruling, but if he wanted to stop enforcement of, by the AG coming and taking away that money, he had to put up a bond. Now, cutting it in half, as was done here, apparently it's not unusual for the appeals court to do that, even if it certainly stands out as remarkable in this case.
Yeah.
Given the size of the penalty that he and his company and its top executives are held liable for after a trial finding that, yes, they committed massive fraud over the past decade or more. But cutting the bond amount is not entirely unprecedented. The bond that Trump is posting with the court now is essentially a placeholder. It guarantees payment if the judgment against him is upheld. At least payment of that much. If that happens, the presumptive Republican presidential nominee will have to pay the state the whole sum still of $454 million plus interest, which is growing daily at like nearly $100,000 a day or some ridiculous amount, even during the appeals process, which could go until later this year. The court lowered the initial number needed for the bond after Trump's lawyers had complained there was, quote, practical impossibility for them to get an underwriter to sign off on a bond for $454 million plus interest. The company that ultimately underwrote the bond that Trump cashed in or turned over on Monday for the lower amount is a company named Knight Specialty Insurance. The chair of that company, it's part of the Knight Insurance Group. The chair of the company is billionaire Don Hanke. He told the AP that both cash and bond were used by Trump as collateral for the bond. Quote, "This is what we do at Knight Insurance, and we're happy to do this for anyone who needs a bond," said Hanke, who is best known in the business world for making high-risk, high-interest loans to car buyers with flawed credit histories.
So he loans to people who are bad credit risks. Okay.
There you go. That's the kind of guy that's the kind of place that Trump had to go in order to get this loan. So I suspect he's paying a pretty high interest rate for it. Or at least he should be. Hanke told the AP he's never met or spoken with Trump, but in an interview with ABC News, he said that he considers himself a Trump supporter, telling them, quote, "We're happy to be able to accommodate the ex-president in this situation. I'd say it's more of a business decision, but I happen to be a supporter also," he said.
And he's getting a lot of free publicity, by the way.
Free publicity and, in theory, a whole bunch of free money that is going to be paid for the fee for this bond, in theory. This is, of course, the civil fraud case in which Trump and his companies and his top executives, including his two eldest sons, were all found to have falsely and vastly inflated the value of assets in the real estate empire that launched Trump to stardom and to the presidency. The falsely inflated values were then used to obtain lower bank rates on loans in what the New York court determined to be a vast, years-long bank, tax, and insurance scam. Under New York law, filing an appeal generally doesn't hold off enforcement of a judgment on its own, but there's an automatic pause, a stay, if the person or entity obtains a bond guaranteeing payment of what is owed, or in this case, part of what is owed. In addition to the $175 million that he had to put up in this New York case, Trump has also posted a bond and cash worth more than $97 million to cover money that he owes to writer E. Jean Carroll while he appeals verdicts in a pair of federal civil trials she filed and won against him as juries found that he sexually assaulted her in the 1990s and then defamed her when she went public with the allegation in 2019. As well, in February, Trump paid almost $400,000 in legal fees that a judge had ordered him to cover for the New York Times and three reporters after he
forgot about that one.
Yeah. After he unsuccessfully sued them over their Pulitzer Prize winning 2018 story about his family's grifting and his family's wealth and tax practices. And then in March, as we told you just a couple weeks ago, a British court ordered Trump to pay legal fees of another nearly $400,000 to a company that he unsuccessfully sued over the so-called Steele dossier that contains salacious allegations about him. So he loses when he goes to court on his own. He loses when he's dragged into court. He's just a loser. This New York appeal on the civil fraud verdict. Yes, it's hard to keep them all apart. This appeal will not be heard until September, though the matter could end up being fully resolved by the New York courts just before the November presidential election in this case. And remember, the interest rate is going up every day while he awaits the appeal.
Right before the election. Oh, goody. And it's going to be fun.
And Trump's other New York case, that would be the criminal case over hundreds of thousands of dollars that were paid in a hush money scheme with a porn star just before and then after the 2016 presidential election. That trial gets underway in Manhattan in just under 2 weeks on April 15, tax day. So it's easy to remember. So there you go on that. And news broke in that matter as well. Just after we got off air from our previous show, the judge in that trial, Juan Merchan, expanded his previous gag order against the former president to declare the judge's daughter and other family members of other parties to the trial to be off limits to attacks by the former president. That just days after Trump attacked and made false claims about the judge's daughter on social media. Judge Merchan said the original gag order, barring Trump from making public statements about jurors and witnesses and others connected to the case, did not include originally his family members, but subsequent attacks now warranted including them. Trump is also now barred from commenting publicly about the family of Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg, though he is still free to go after both Bragg and Judge Merchan himself. Quote, "This pattern of attacking family members of presiding jurists and attorneys assigned to his cases serves no legitimate purpose. It merely injects fear in those assigned or called to participate in the proceedings that not only they, but their family members as well are, quote, fair game for defendants' vitriol," Judge Merchan wrote, italicizing himself the words, "but their family members as well." He then added, quote, "The average observer must now, after hearing defendants' recent attacks, draw the conclusion that if they become involved in these proceedings, even tangentially, they should worry not only for themselves, but for their loved ones as well," in italics. "Such concerns will undoubtedly interfere with the fair administration of justice and constitutes a direct attack on the rule on the rule of law itself," the judge wrote. Furthermore, he excoriated Trump's claims in his opposition filing to this expanded gag order that he had no choice. He had no choice but to attack the judge's daughter and others, by the way, with false claims about her based on a fraudulent Twitter account that she had nothing to do with. The judge wrote, quote, "The arguments counsel makes are at best strained and at worst baseless misrepresentations, which are uncorroborated and rely upon innuendo and exaggeration. Put mildly, the assortment of allegations presented as, quote, facts and cobbled together result in accusations that are disingenuous and not rational. To argue that the most recent attacks, which included photographs of the judge's daughter, by the way, were, quote, necessary and appropriate in the current environment, unquote, is farcical," the judge wrote.
That's another way of saying a lie.
So this judge, at least, it seems, the one that will be overseeing what will become the first ever criminal trial of a former president, where he'll be facing 34 criminal felony counts in that trial. That judge, at least, seems to get it, seems to get what Trump is trying to do here. He seems to fully understand, you know, what Trump is up to.
His intimidation strategy.
Yeah, and basically saying he will have none of it. He makes that clear in his Monday ruling that violations of this now expanded gag order could result in Trump being held in contempt of court, being fined, or yes, even jailed, even though, as we discussed on yesterday's show, that might be something that Trump actually wants. I'm not sure he does, though. Hard to take care of your hair behind bars. Trump criticized Judge Merchan and his daughter, who's a Democratic political consultant, in a series of social media posts last week, just one day after the judge had issued his original gag order barring Trump from attacking witnesses and court staff, etc. But not, he didn't mention family members. So there you go. I guess you get to attack them. Another post over the Easter weekend by Trump included a photo of the judge's daughter. Did he include a target over it? He might as well have. Merchan's gag order echoes the one that has already been applied in Trump's criminal cases in D.C. related to his attempts to steal the 2020 election, as well as the gag order he faced in the New York civil fraud trial, in which he was found to owe the state nearly $500 million. Meanwhile, down in Florida, on Monday night, more news. The Florida Supreme Court paved the way for the state's six-week abortion ban to take effect, while at the same time, in a ray of hope, the court allowed Florida voters to decide this fall whether to enshrine abortion protections into the state's constitution by overturning decades of precedent in the Sunshine State. Because apparently precedent no longer means anything in our court system, whether it's at the state level or the federal level. By overturning those decades, Florida's current 15-week ban on abortion will now go into effect. The state Supreme Court, with five of the seven justices appointed by far-right Governor Ron DeSantis, then subsequently triggered a separate six-week abortion ban that was approved by Florida GOP lawmakers last year. So the 15-week big government ban on reproductive freedoms in Florida is now allowed, but it is about to get much worse, barring abortion rights entirely from any women who have no idea that they're even pregnant in the first 6 weeks.
Really important to make that clear, that in practical terms, a six-week ban is a total effective ban.
But let me get to the better news so people don't want to throw themselves out of a window just yet. In a separate ruling on Monday, the same court, along a narrow 4-3 vote, also approved the wording of a proposed state constitutional amendment that would protect the right to an abortion in Florida. That clears the way for the measure to go on the ballot this November. It will be Amendment 4, and it could potentially undo both of those big government bans, 15 weeks and 6 weeks, if voters turn out in Florida. And by the way, if they're allowed to vote in Florida, which is never a guarantee in that state, making things even more challenging, even with that amendment. Constitutional amendments in Florida, you may recall, need the support of at least 60% of voters to be approved. A mere majority is not enough in the state of Florida.
Yeah, the Republican state legislature had to put a stop to that.
So that 60% could be critical. While protections for reproductive rights have been consistently adopted by voters, even in very red states, states that are redder than Florida, since the corrupt U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade in 2022. The big vote in favor of abortion rights in Kansas, for example, that same year, that kept abortion legal in the state, but it got just 59% of the vote. A more recent vote in Ohio, that won with 56.6% of the vote. So, you know, this amendment offers hope down in Florida, but it is not a slam dunk. Also, the Florida Republicans, who currently control the legislature there, they also have a habit of passing laws after constitutional amendments are adopted by voters that end up nullifying those constitutional amendments in various ways. But we'll cross that bridge when and if we get to it. Our friend Chris Geidner of Law Dork noted on Monday night the abortion measure was approved for ballot placement by the Florida Supremes on a narrow 4-3 vote, with all three female justices on the court, all DeSantis appointees, voting against letting the people vote on this question. There is a special place in hell for those ladies.
Yes, there is.
Until the voters get to have their say in November, Monday's ruling will now make Florida one of the most restrictive states in the nation to obtain an abortion. It will set up an all-out presidential year fight over reproductive rights in the Sunshine State. The Biden campaign on Monday cast Florida, a longtime swing state that has trended Republican in recent years, as, quote, winnable this November as it seeks to mobilize voters around abortion rights. We'll see. In January, Floridians Protecting Freedom, the coalition behind the ballot initiative, gathered just under 1 million signatures of registered voters to qualify for Florida Supreme Court review. Justices had to decide if the amendment's language is clear, unambiguous, and would not confuse voters. Well, the wording for the proposed amendment that's going to be on the ballot reads pretty damned clear to me. Quote, no law shall prohibit, penalize, delay, or restrict abortion before viability or when necessary to protect the patient's health as determined by the patient's health care provider. This amendment does not change the legislature's constitutional authority to require notification to a parent or guardian before a minor has an abortion. So that sounds very clear, and yet that was the language that was challenged by Ron DeSantis' attorney general in the state, Ashley Moody, as being unclear. She asked the court to kill the amendment due to language she argued was vague and confusing, with the aim of tricking voters. Now, what could possibly be seen as vague or unclear or tricking voters with that simple language is frankly beyond me. But, you know, big government fascists who like to come between patients and their doctors don't seem to care much about facts or reality, particularly down in DeSantis's Florida. Happily, though, even this Florida Supreme Court, with a majority seated by DeSantis himself, saw through that, at least for now. On Monday, the state justices wrote in their opinion, quote, it cannot be said that the ballot summary will mislead voters regarding the actual text of the proposed amendment. The campaign director for Yes on 4, Lauren Brenzel, said in a statement, this is our chance to engage in direct democracy to stop these unpopular and harmful policies. She said, we are thrilled Floridians will have the opportunity to reclaim their bodily autonomy and freedom from government interference by voting for Amendment 4 this November. And I got to tell you, it keeps coming back in my head because, boy, we covered it for a lot of years on this show and on the broadcast. Back when they were passing the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, and Republicans were just furious about the idea that government was going to come between a doctor and their patients. Quaint, isn't it? And that's not the only ruling, by the way, from Florida's High Court, if you will pardon the pun here, that might give hope to opponents of big government autocracy down in Florida on Monday. The court also approved language on Amendment 3, which will allow Florida voters to decide whether to legalize recreational marijuana in November. The constitutional amendment could authorize the use of recreational marijuana for adults 21 and older. The proposal was, of course, challenged again by the state's Republican Attorney General Moody. She questioned the amendment's language and its potential to violate a requirement that ballot initiatives stick to a single subject. The justices rejected both of those arguments in their majority opinion. The amendment will also, however, need approval from 60% of voters to pass. But both amendments, state Democrats and the Biden campaign hope, may, now, we'll see, put Florida back into play this year.
Yeah, hopefully it will bring out more youth voters who will presumably be interested in, if not their own reproductive rights, then perhaps in the ability to use recreational marijuana.
To get baked.
Yeah.
By the way, even though we sort of have begun to think of Florida as a red state, Trump only won the state back in 2016 by just over 1 point. It was a wider margin for him in 2020. He won by almost 3.5 points. But still, that's 3.5 points. That is reversible. So keep your eyes on Florida this year. And in somewhat related news, it looks like Arizona voters will also be voting to protect reproductive freedoms on the ballot this November. But that is not all that they may be voting on if the Republican-controlled state legislature there has its way. The state legislature in Arizona is now just one vote away from asking Arizonans if they want to vote like it's 1990. A resolution in the state house would abolish early voting. It would curb the use of vote centers. It would revert to election day only voting at a precinct. It now needs a vote only of the full GOP-controlled Senate to be sent to the November ballot, where voters will have the final say on this. Now, it cannot be vetoed by Arizona's Democratic Governor Katie Hobbs because it's a ballot measure, so it doesn't go to her. It just goes straight to the ballot if it's approved in both houses of the state legislature. So it would then be up to voters this November to reject that.
So they'll have a chance to reject it because, as I understand it, most of Arizona votes by mail.
Correct.
So those people will have a chance to reject the Republicans' attempt to stop them from being able to vote by mail.
To vote by mail. Exactly. And at convenient voting centers and so forth. The proposal caps years of efforts by Republicans to reverse many of the election changes that have been made over the years in the name of convenience and efficiency, according to the Arizona Republic.
Oh, God, efficiency. You're kidding. That's terrible.
Election officials call this measure, quote, the big one. That's according to election officials, the big one of 2024's suite of election-related legislation, because of its potential cost and wide-ranging changes to how Arizona votes. The measure would scrap early voting, meaning most voters would have to cast their ballots at the polls only on election day. It will dial back the use of voting centers, which allow voters to vote at any center in their county of residence that is convenient for them at any time, by the way, either before or on election day. But it will dial back the use of those voting centers only in Democratic-leaning counties, Maricopa and Pima, where the huge bulk of the state's voters actually live. But it would allow the convenience of voting centers to continue in the state's other, more rural and, yes, right-leaning counties. Go figure. Well, the debate over precincts and voting centers has been rolling all legislative session long, notes the Republic. The abolition of early voting, that is new. That sort of came out of nowhere recently. Senator Wendy Rogers, far right winger out of Flagstaff, she added the provision during the last meeting of the year at the Senate Elections Committee, which she chairs. She offered no explanation for that amendment, but I think we all know why she did it.
Yeah.
Early voting has been practiced in Arizona for more than 3 decades, and as Desi notes, it is highly popular. In last month's presidential preference election, for example, 95% of the vote in Maricopa County, that's Phoenix, came in by mail or by early voting, thanks to the state's permanent mail voter list, which would largely be abolished if voters approve this measure this November. As Daily Coast election expert Stephen Wolf notes, in response to this news over the weekend, Arizona Democrats need to flip just 2 swing seats in each legislative chamber this fall to win back majorities. in both houses and start expanding voting access. Seems like Republicans in the state legislature may be begging for that to happen at this point, even as they continue to pretend that massive voter fraud by Democrats is why Republicans keep losing elections. Hint, it ain't voter fraud. At least that ain't why you keep losing elections, Republicans. Let's take a quick break here. We will come back with some actual voter and election fraud and voter suppression news from elsewhere around the nation this week, which underscores again which party is really carrying out fraud when it comes to elections. That's straight ahead, followed by the return of Desi Doyen's Green News Report.
Yay!
I'm Brad Friedman. You are listening to the Bradcast.
The Bradcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Please help us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations around the nation. Please drop by bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
There will be justice by the time this segment ends. I promise you that. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. At least some justice. On yesterday's show with our friends Driftglass and Fran from the Pro Left podcast, we covered a whole bunch of stuff that happened while we were off on spring break, including the sort of mind-blowing news out of Alabama, where Marilyn Lanz, a Democrat, won a state legislative special election by 25 points. She flipped the seat for the state legislative seat from red to blue in a state where reproductive rights have become newly controversial again after the state Supreme Court's recently outlawed in vitro fertilization on the basis that frozen embryos created during the IVF process are, in fact, actual children. So Lanz won that seat last week in the special election by 25 points after focusing her candidacy on reproductive rights. And that was after she had lost her race for that same seat against a Republican named David Cole back in the 2022 general election by 7 points. She lost by 7 points in 22. She won by 25 points.
Wow.
Just 2 years later in this special election. So that's amazing enough on its own. But what I didn't have time to cover when we discussed that story yesterday was why there was a special election in Alabama for the state legislative seat in the first place. Lanz won only because the seat that she ran for in 22 became empty because the Republican who beat her that year, Republican Rep. David Cole, was forced to step down and plead guilty to election fraud after it became clear that he had rented a closet-sized space in someone's home in the district that he ran in order to fraudulently run for office in that district where he did not live. That is election fraud. And Republicans seem to commit it all the time. And in Alabama, that is fraud specifically. That forced Cole to vacate the seat that led to last week's special election and the seat being flipped ultimately from red to blue by Marilyn Lanz. But that is hardly the only story of Republican officials fraudulently voting that broke in just the week that we were off last
but
week.
But wait, there's more.
There is. A judge ruled last week that the Georgia Republican Party's first vice chair, a guy by the name of Brian Pritchard, violated state election laws when he voted unlawfully 9 times while he was serving probation for a felony check forgery sentence. Pritchard, a right-wing talk show host, sadly won't be going to jail, as he might if he had made the mistake of being either a Democrat or a person of color. He'll only have to pay a $5,000 fine and receive a public reprimand from the state election board. That according to the decision by a state administrative law judge in Georgia. Pritchard has previously alleged that the 2020 presidential election was fraudulent on his program, despite any actual evidence to demonstrate as much. But now he has been found to have actually voted illegally, yes, 9 times. Now, it's in different elections, as I understand it. He claimed he didn't do anything wrong, however, that he had completed his probation before voting in Georgia, but that did not convince the judge. Judge Lisa Boggs wrote in her 25-page decision, quote, "The court does not find the respondent's explanations credible or convincing. At the very least, if the court accepts he did not know about his felony sentences, the record before this court demonstrates that he should have known." Pritchard testified in February that he believed his felony sentence had ended back in 1999. But attorneys for the state showed evidence that his probation had been repeatedly revoked and extended until 2011. Georgia law prohibits felons from voting until they have completed their entire sentences. Pritchard registered to vote in Georgia in 2008. He cast ballots thereafter in 9 elections before his probation was over, according to election records that were presented in the court. He pleaded guilty in 1996 to forgery and theft charges involving some $38,000 worth of checks that he deposited while working on a construction job. His probation initially lasted just 3 years, but Pennsylvania judges repeatedly extended it until 2011 on allegations that Pritchard had failed to pay restitutions. Attorneys for the state said in court that Pritchard knew he was still serving his sentences because records show that he appeared in Pennsylvania court for probation hearings in 1999, in 2002, in 2004. When he came to Georgia, according to the senior assistant AG in Georgia during closing arguments in February, he was aware that he was registering to vote illegally. He knew that he went in all 9 times and signed that voter certificate. He was voting illegally. The judge fined Pritchard $500 for each of the 9 times that he voted illegally, which frankly is a pretty damn good deal. Plus another $500 for his illegal voter registration. Before becoming a Republican Party official, Pritchard ran unsuccessfully last year for a seat in the state's House of Representatives. But even if you believe that Pritchard had no idea that he was allowed to vote while on felony probation, or that he was even on probation, it's kind of difficult to feel sorry for this guy, given how Democrats and, yes, people of color have been treated when it comes to similar and, I must say, even far less criminal actions. As you know, since Republicans decided to pretend that the election was stolen from them by massive, if evidence-free, fraud across the nation and in states like Georgia— back in 2020, the only election crimes of note have really been voter fraud cases committed largely by Republican white guys who tried to vote, for example, in 2 different states at the same time, claiming that because they owned houses in 2 different states, they thought they were entitled to do so. Or they knew better and they did it anyway. Or they voted unlawfully for a deceased family member or something like that. In almost all of those cases, and we've reported quite a few of them since 2020 on this program, in almost all of them that have come to light since then, it has been Republican voters who were committing that fraud. And by the way, they generally get off with little more than a slap on the wrist, as was the case with Pritchard. Yes, $5,000, but he voted illegally 9 times and registered unlawfully once. Democrats, on the other hand, or people of color, do not seem to get off quite as easily. But we've got some happier news in that regard today on a story that we've been covering at this point now for years on this show. In 2016, Crystal Mason A black woman from Texas was sentenced to 5 years in prison. 5 years in prison for voting just once while she was on probation. After, like the white Republican Pritchard in Georgia, after being convicted to felony crimes years earlier, Pritchard voted for tax-related crimes in her case. Pritchard voted nine times unlawfully. He received a $5,000 fine. Mason voted once, and she received 5 years in prison. And guess what? She didn't even vote once. She tried to vote once, but she was told she was not registered, and so a poll worker told her to go ahead and vote with a provisional ballot, a ballot that was never even counted, even while she had no idea that she was not allowed to vote in the state in the first place. So we have been citing this story for years, pretty much every time some white Republican dude gets off with a slap on the wrist for doing far worse and doing it usually on purpose. Well, now, finally, some good news for Crystal Mason, some long overdue good news. A Texas appeals court has finally thrown out her 5-year sentence for trying to cast a provisional ballot that was rejected in the 2016 presidential election. Mason, who is now 49 years old, attempted to vote in Fort Worth in 2016, even though she was ineligible because she was still on supervised release, which is a form of like probation for a tax felony. She's always maintained she had no idea she was ineligible, and she only tried to cast a ballot because her mother had urged her to that year. A judge convicted her in a 2018 trial that lasted just a few hours. Her probation officials testified at the trial that they never told her that she was ineligible. She was never told, according to her own probation officials. But in 2020, the Court of Appeals for the Second Appellate District in Texas said that the fact that Mason did not know she was ineligible to vote was, quote, irrelevant. Her case became well known. It was an example of an egregious punishment for a voting mistake. And, of course, as a thinly veiled effort to intimidate black voters in Texas. In 2022, Texas's highest criminal court told the Second Court of Appeals they had to reconsider the ruling upholding the conviction. And on Thursday last week, that court said there was insufficient evidence that Mason knew she was ineligible to vote. Justice Wade Birdwell wrote for the court in its Thursday ruling, quote, "We conclude that the quantum of the evidence presented in this case is insufficient to support the conclusion that Mason actually realized that she voted knowing she was ineligible to do so, and therefore insufficient to support her conviction for illegal voting." Now, Mason has remained out of prison on an appeal bond for all of these years. She said on Thursday evening that she received the news while she was going through a drive-thru. She became emotional. She said, quote, "I was thrown into this fight for voting rights and will keep swinging to ensure no other citizen has to face what I've faced and endured for the past 7 years." She called it a political ploy where minority voting rights are under attack. She was not particularly involved in politics prior to her case, but she's since become much more engaged in raising awareness about voting rights. A key piece of evidence in the case was testimony from the head poll worker, who happens to be Mason's neighbor, who assisted her with filling out the provisional ballot at the time. Before submitting it, he said he went over an affidavit with her, which she had to affirm, saying she was not serving a criminal sentence. The affidavit, however, is poorly designed. It has an admonition in both English and Spanish in relatively small print. On one side, it requires the voter to fill out information on the other side. Mason signed the affidavit, but says she never understood that it meant she was not allowed to vote. And on Thursday, the court agreed there was not sufficient evidence that she actually realized she couldn't. Even if she had read the admonitions, said Justice Birdwell, they are not sufficient to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that she actually knew that being on supervised release after having served her entire federal sentence of incarceration also made her ineligible to vote by casting a provisional ballot. Thomas Booser Clancy, an attorney for the ACLU of Texas, called the ruling a victory for democracy, saying Miss Mason never should have been prosecuted for what was at worst an innocent misunderstanding. 5 years she was sentenced to 5 years in jail for this mistake. Booser Clancy noted that the ballot wasn't even counted because she was not a registered voter and said the case should have ended there. Kim Cole, one of Mason's attorneys, called the prosecution malicious and politically motivated. The state's prosecution, she said, specifically stated that they wanted to, quote, send a message to voters. They deliberately put Crystal through over 6 years of pure hell. In 2021, by the way, after passing a new voting law measure over the objection of Democrats in Texas, the GOP-controlled state house approved a resolution stating that, quote, a person should not be criminally incarcerated for making an innocent mistake. That is in law in Texas. Now, as of 2021, still, Crystal Mason spent the next 3 years thereafter still fighting to have this ridiculous sentence done away with. The Sentencing Project, which advocates for reducing punishment and expanding voting rights of felons nationwide, says Texas leads the nation by disenfranchising some 450,000 citizens, or 2.5% of the state's voting age population. About 2/3 of them are Black or Latino. It is not a mistake that Texas has, I believe, the lowest voter turnout rate in the nation. Allison Grinter Allen, one of Mason's lawyers, said, quote, Crystal has gone through so much, and all of Texas owes her a great debt of gratitude. Through 8 years, never once did she stop fighting. Never once did she take her eyes off the fact that this case was about every single voter in Texas. Despite her acquittal, now the case has taken a significant toll on Mason and her family, as she noted during a video statement on Friday.
It's been overwhelming. I cried and hollered when I got the news. Trying not to cry now, but 7 years. I've been out for 6 years on an appeal bond, 1 foot in and 1 foot out, not knowing if I was going to go to prison. So I'm really humbly grateful right now on the outcome. I lost jobs, lost good jobs, lost insurance. Just every night crying, praying, asking God, when is the end? You know, I knew victory would be the outcome. I can tell you that. It's been really rough. And when I got the news yesterday, I was just overwhelmed with joy. It's been a long journey.
After she was arrested for this, back in 2017, she lost her job at a bank. She was sent back to federal prison for several months for being arrested while on probation for a federal crime, one that, you know, she has now been acquitted of. During that time, she almost lost her home to foreclosure. She said in a statement, she's cried for 7 years straight, 7 nights a week. She says, I've also prayed for 7 years straight, 7 nights a week, prayed that I would remain a free Black woman. She said, I am overjoyed to see my faith rewarded today. Finally. And frankly, so are we. Green News Report is next on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. You're listening to the broadcast. We are 100% listener-supported thanks to listeners like you who stop by bradblog.com/donate. So, Desi Doyen, I have basically spent the last 2 days trying to get caught up from from the last week or so of news, yeah. Even as new news comes in. And I don't think I'm not caught up. Still got a lot to cover.
I know.
You get to do that in about 6 minutes' time.
Yes, and I didn't get all of it.
There's more to come,
tried.
But you tried. On our latest Green News Report.
It's my intention that federal government will pay for the entire cost of reconstructing that bridge. And I expect the Congress to support my effort.
Biden vows to rebuild Baltimore's key bridge. Republicans say maybe. New study confirms the economic toll of man-made climate change. Plus, Biden administration clamps down on big oil methane leaks, truck pollution, and much more.
All of those clampdowns and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
Yeah, it was kind of outrageous immediately for Biden to express in this tragedy the idea that he's going to use federal funds to pay for in entirety. We just can't take the easy route all the time and just try to spend the taxpayers' money.
Right. Let's rebuild it with fairy dust. Congressman Dan Muser of Pennsylvania, good thing it wasn't in your state, I guess, eh? This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, I know you got a lot to get to today.
Yep.
We've been off for a while, but these heavy rains in California continue. And over the weekend, a giant chunk of the road, California's iconic Highway 1, the Pacific Coast Highway, just fell away up in Big Sur, hundreds of feet into the ocean. The roads are now closed. Apparently, nobody was killed, miraculously, but it stranded as many as 1,600 people in the coastal community of Big Sur. I can't think of any more beautiful places in the world to be stranded, frankly, but having driven that road along the cliffs of Big Sur, the idea of the road dropping out and into the ocean is horrifying.
Yes, and it underscores that our infrastructure is really not built for climate change.
No, it's not.
On Monday, officials in Baltimore opened a small channel to allow limited shipping to resume after the tragic collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge last week, killing six workers and destroying a vital transit and shipping corridor critical to the economy of the East Coast. The tragic accident underscores the fragility of America's transportation and supply chain infrastructure. President Biden will visit the site this week and vowed that the federal government will pay the cost to replace the bridge, like it has in the past, to ensure speedy reconstruction. But some congressional Republicans attacked the idea of any new funds without budget cuts elsewhere while promoting specious and sometimes racist theories as to why the bridge collapsed. On MSNBC, Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg countered,
"This really needs to be a bipartisan priority because it could be your district that is the next one to be struck by tragedy. And we always do better when America comes together. There's nothing partisan about a road or a bridge."
There is now.
While we were out, a new study confirmed the economic toll of human-caused climate change. Researchers at the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research say that the costs of climate change are rippling through entire economies, finding that increasing temperatures and extreme weather events like more intense and frequent heat waves and storms are also increasing inflation, already driving up the price of food and other goods worldwide. They warn that the trends are likely to worsen through 2035. In other news, the Biden administration got very busy issuing a slew of new standards to cut the nation's pollution and emissions and to combat climate change. The Interior Department finalized rules requiring oil and gas drillers on public lands to curb leaks and flaring of methane, a potent greenhouse gas that is a significant contributor to global warming. The new rules, the first in 40 years, target emissions from both new and existing oil and gas wells.
Good.
That matters because a new study found that actual methane emissions from the oil and gas industry are triple the industry's self-reported estimates. The researchers calculate that the wasted methane was worth about $1 billion in commercial value, and climate-related damages and social costs were roughly $9 billion annually.
And that's money that would be coming to the U.S. government in royalties if it was not just flared off, correct?
Exactly. And finally, the Environmental Protection Agency rolled out the strongest ever emission standards for large, heavy-duty vehicles to cut pollution and the emissions that cause dangerous climate change. The new rules will take effect for model years 2027 through 2032 and apply to new heavy-duty trucks, buses, commercial vans, and freight trucks. The rules do not mandate or ban any technology. Manufacturers choose how to meet the standards. Although heavy-duty trucks are only 5% of U.S. road traffic, they are a significant contributor to U.S. emissions and pollution, generating more than half of the smog and soot that Americans breathe. EPA projects the new standards will provide $13 billion in net public health benefits from avoided illnesses and deaths, particularly for the 72 million Americans living near freight corridors who bear the brunt of air pollution.
Well, no wonder the Republicans are against it.
Yep.
For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Just keep chugging on.
Thank you very much, Desi Doyen.
Yeah, so that's some good news for breathers.
There you go. I must say, since we laid down the Green News Report, and I mentioned that story about Highway 1 falling away, dropping off the side of that cliff near
sad.
Big Sur.
Yes.
I've been looking at videos of that, and just looking at the videos of it makes me queasy.
Mm-hmm.
Where the road has fallen away, the road is like hanging on to the side of the cliff a
yes.
couple of hundred feet over the ocean.
Yeah, if you don't know, it's a very scenic route, but it does literally have the ocean right there.
Over the cliff. I think it is the most beautiful road I have ever driven on. It's gorgeous. If you get a chance, everyone should take this ride along the coast
yes.
up to Big Sur. But when you get a chance, I guess do it because the road fallen away a year or two ago. There was a mudslide also because of unrelenting rains that shut down that road for a while.
It's unclear how much longer the PCH, the Pacific Coast Highway, will last these days.
It is kind of disappearing piece by piece, isn't it?
Yeah.
Hopefully when no one is on it. All right, we've got to get out. Thanks again to our producer, Desi Doyen. Thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. It is always an honor and greatly appreciated. If you missed any portion of today's show or any other, download it for free at bradblog.com. That is made possible by those of you kind enough and generous enough to stop by bradblog.com/donate or just hit one of the donate buttons at bradblog.com to help us stay on your public airwaves. Now is a great time, by the way, to sign up for a subscription for any amount you like. It's an automated subscription once a month. It helps us continue to do what we try to do every day, at least through this election year. Thank you in advance. Drop me email. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com on the Facebooks, Mastodons, and sites still known as Twitter. I am the Brad Blog. We will see you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
Take a place to go and just keep trucking on home.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1937. That was the day workers at the Hershey Candy Plant in Hershey, Pennsylvania, sat down. CIO organizers for the new United Chocolate Workers Union reported that anywhere from 2,000 to 2,400 workers were on strike. Hershey was a company town where streets were named Chocolate and Coca Avenue. Housing was built for workers and the company funded public education and transit service. But the company also sought to monitor and control workers' behavior on their off time and showed favoritism in hiring and wages. The Great Depression created dire conditions even in the sweetest place on earth. Hours and bonuses had been cut. Workers grew increasingly frustrated with production speed up and unpredictable work schedules, all while Hershey still drew handsome profits. The company initially raised wages after meeting with the union, but then laid off the organizers 3 months later. That's when the workers shut off their machines and occupied the plant. The company refused to negotiate unless the workers left. By April 7th, dairy farmers became incensed at the loss of income. They mobilized with anti-union company forces to storm the factory and drive the strikers out. Organizers had agreed to end the strike in order to resume negotiations and avert violence. But the anti-union forces attacked the sit-downers with bats, whips, clubs, and hammers. Three CIO organizers were singled out and severely beaten. Governor George Earl condemned the attack and blamed the county sheriff for suppressing labor rather than preventing mob rule. The strike was smashed. Attempts to install a company union failed soon after. Hershey would be one of the first candy companies to be organized when the Bakery, Confectionery, Tobacco Workers, and Grain Millers International Union won recognition 2 years later.
Labor History in Two brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show.